From the high desert of northern New Mexico, this is Circle for Original Thinking. I'm your host, Glenn Aparicio Perry. Welcome to Circle for Original Thinking, America's electronic talking circle for visionary thinkers. An open forum for fresh ideas and timeless wisdom applied to today's political and ecological challenges. Each episode, we bring together creative thinkers from a variety of different traditions. We ask the hard questions on the important issues of the day: political polarization, climate change, virulent viruses, and other symptoms of humanity being out of balance with the natural world. Our goal is to recreate a whole and sacred America and world, a new and improved version of E Pluribus Unum, from the many to the one, and this time not leave anybody out. Join us as we embark on this quest. A community of Earth systems scientists recently at the Stockholm Resilience Center asked a powerful question. How do we define a safe operating space for humanity with all that is currently known about the Earth, Earth's various systems? They determined that there are 9 critical thresholds that together define a safe operating space for humanity: biosphere integrity, climate change, land system change, freshwater use, biogeochemical flows of nitrogen and phosphorus, ocean acidification, atmospheric aerosol loading, stratospheric ozone depletion, and they also added one other catch-all category for unimagined risks. If we cross any one of these thresholds, it could be game over for humanity, they say. And by some estimates, we have already crossed 4, other estimates say 6 of them. Enter Joe Brewer. He has written a book called The Design Pathway for Regenerating Earth that addresses the intentional application of knowledge and tools to create solutions for regenerating living systems. Feasible methods for getting all 9 boundary dynamics back within acceptable limits. Joe does admit that this is a gargantuan task and one that will require working through inner grief and trauma while experiencing the already occurring effects of planetary collapse. Enter Bill Pfeiffer, Sky Otter, a dear friend who, as much as anyone I know, is doing something about changing our inner attitude about how to engage with the Earth, to engage with wildness, to live an ecstatic life in harmony and balance with all there is. The author of Wild Earth, Wild Soul, a manual for an ecstatic culture. His method for enacting change has been to design wild earth intensives that bring people into sacred community and provide a microcosm for a future sustainable society. Now, I wanted to bring these two guests together to represent both the outer and inner solutions for the seemingly intractable ecological challenges we now face. So join us today as we explore restoring health to our planet on the next episode of the Circle for Original Thinking podcast. Now, how's everybody doing today?
We're good here in Vermont.
Good?
I'm really good here in the Northern Andes in Colombia.
That's so beautiful. I have been to Colombia. I've been up to the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta Mountains with the Arhuaco Mamos and the Kogi. And yeah, that's the heart of Mother Earth. So you're right near there. So thank you. Thank you. Well, that's, we've got a lot to talk about today, and we said our prayers before we even began. We're trying to rethink our approach as humans, but I wanted to begin by asking you just a very easy question. Not really, but, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be human? I want to go to you first, Joe. You mentioned this theme quite a few times in your book, so I'm gonna go to you first. If you pass the talking staff to you,
what does it mean to be human? I think it helps to give maybe 2 different contexts to begin answering this question. One context is the 3.5 billion year evolutionary history of the planet, where there's been continuous life on Earth going back for a very long time. And then what kind of animal are we? What kind of a biological being is this human in the context of that history? And then the other one, so I'm going to sort of blend these. And then the other one is, what does it mean to be human in a moment like the one we're in now, where geologists who are very, very risk averse to adding new geologic ages have decided to name this one after humans because of the outsized impact that we're having by naming it the Anthropocene. And so I want to sort of touch on it in both ways. And so I'll start by saying that to understand humans in the context of this great menagerie of evolution, we need to understand that, you know, we're multicellular organisms. We have an endoskeleton. We have a central nervous system. We have very complex emotions, including social emotions. We have language and conceptual systems, the ability to live in a semantic world of the making of our minds. And so there's something already very interesting about us and maybe even different. Mm. And I want to offer the juxtaposition as how are humans different from the rest of life? Because there's been a lot of hubris in answering this question. You know, humans are the only ones who are intelligent. Wait a second. A few more advances in science. Turns out that was pretty dumb. And, you know, maybe humans are the only ones with language. Well, it depends on which aspect of language, which is a complex mix of things and so on. And I remember in 2017, when I was on the founding team to create a scientific society for the study of cultural evolution, and I was just looking at what was the consensus view of mainstream science as of that time across many different disciplines? Because these were the people who were the most skilled at, you know, cutting away the hubris of false ideas of human separation, saying, well, you know, a bird song can evolve like a language and whale song can evolve like a language. And they would take humans off of their uniqueness pedestal in various ways. But the one way that they couldn't seem to take humans off the pedestal, well, pedestals may be the wrong thing, doesn't make humans better or above with respect to other humans. But the one thing humans seem to be capable of doing that no other organism has any evidence of doing is engaging in cumulative cultural evolution, which is that our evolutionary patterns as they relate to culture can accumulate in directions that can grow exponentially, which is that we can scaffold future cultural change on existing and previous cultural change. And that we do this with things like language, with technology, with models of social organization, and whole bunch of interesting elements to it. Like we do guided and directed instruction, which is not that one, that's one that is not unique to humans, but it's very uncommon. And it might be reserved primarily to a few other mammals. And so what's interesting is to notice that humans are distinguished from the rest of the biological world by having the ability to get lost in our dreams and fantasy and come to believe we're separate from the rest of life and then grow so far from our foundations as to potentially create our own extinction event. And so what's interesting about cumulative cultural evolution is just like if you look at the latest version of the iPhone and go back to previous versions, you'll notice that the complexity is accumulating in an accelerating rate, and that the number of different versions of the iPhone, they've been growing to have a larger number in a shorter period of time. That the way that we build socio-technological systems can have this kind of accumulation. And then we don't see evidence of this in any other species. So what does it mean to be human? Is to be a rather uncommon primate within the mammalian larger family that has the ability to live in semantic or imagined worlds that may or may not have any bearing whatsoever on the rest of reality. And that we can grow ourselves into what could be like painting ourselves into the corner of an evolutionary bottleneck. And so that relates to the second meaning, the Anthropocene, which is that humans are also one of the few times in the history of life on Earth where a single species or a small category of species could change the trajectory of the entire Earth system. was the previous one being cyanobacteria, when they evolved into the ocean, you know, a long, long time ago, a couple billion years ago, and they would excrete such large amounts of oxygen that they actually caused a mass extinction event, but then opened the pathway for multicellular organisms. And so that wasn't a single species. It was a class of single-celled organisms. But humans seem to take the cake when it comes to being the only species that, as a singular species, can disrupt the planet's self-regulatory patterns. And so I think it's important to notice that cumulative cultural evolution may be our Achilles heel. It could be like a superpower, but it also could be the key to our downfall.
Mm-hmm.
Back to that, recognizing that we should not be too arrogant about ourselves, even though there are some things that make us special.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful, Joe. I turn it over to you, Sky Otter. What does it mean to be human?
Yeah, I got the question. I just want to say that was beautiful, Joe. I loved listening to that. You know, it's a kind of summary, in my view, of both the best science and the best cultural lens we can look at the current state of affairs. But actually, Glenn, when you asked the question, the first thought that came to my mind was, I don't know. I have no idea what it means to be human. And I mean that in all sincerity. And then the next thought that came to my mind is, the root of human is humus, or it's the soil, is this, like, this sensuous body that gives life. I mean, we are land dwellers. We're two-legged. We walk with the land. And so the I don't know is really, when I think about it, based on human is sort of a linguistic phenomenon where we kind of take out this, we take out the mammal from the ecosystem. And when I lead these groups that I've been, any kind of group these days, the one class that I give that came to my mind was landscape shamanism. The main point of the class is for us to not only love deeply out of a knowing of our landscape, not just because of the incredible diversity, but also because we are one with this landscape. And so this is the mind shift that I'm thinking about and working on 24/7 is, yes, let's say language and science are these amazing tools, but as Joe was implying, it could be our downfall if we think that we're just these abstractions. And as he said, the main lethal abstraction is I am a separate self. You are out there. The land is out there. I can do what I want with the water because it doesn't affect me, and on and on and on. The both of you have heard some version of what I'm saying ad nauseum. But for me, the game changer is I am human when I experientially I'm truly human when I experientially understand that I'm not only an individual, but I'm one with, I mean, individual in air quotes here, individual with, and most predominantly, one with the cosmos.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Bill, the original meaning of individual is undivided.
Okay.
So it's, if you want to, like I think you just did, you can take that out to the complete extrapolation and one with the cosmos. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate this conversation greatly. I mean, I think it's important. I mean, I often think, you know, remember when the Human Genome Project got started and people were, you know, they thought that if they could, you know, find out the, you know, everything about the human DNA, then they would find out why humans are unique. But they actually found out the opposite. I mean, they found out, you know, we do share like 98% or a little more than 98% of DNA with a chimpanzee, but we also share 50% DNA with a banana. I mean, we're interconnected with everything. So it's you know, and when we start to talk, Joe's talking about the what was it, the cyanobacteria, one of the original bacterial forms. Well, yeah, I mean, our oldest ancestor is what, Luka, right? And I don't mean Luka Doncic, who plays with the basketball. I mean, we are the ancestor. These ancestral beings are living within us, too. They're not just ancestors that we can pray to. They're actually within us in large numbers. So, I mean, you know, I mean, when they started to say statements, when scientists started to say statements like, you know, their bacterial cells are more than 50% of the human, what does that even mean? You know, so, I mean, and if our DNA is like, you know, 97% of, you know, non-human or something, what is, how are we human then? It really becomes quite complex. So that's why I appreciate what you're doing, Sky Otter, when you're bringing together your groups on your ecstatic journeys. And I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more about how you get them to connect with the earth when you bring them together for these Wild Earth intensives. How do you bring them to this awareness? Maybe they're already there, but I think a lot of them are discovering this, an awareness of their radical interconnection with the land. How do you do that?
I think the funny phrase is, I want to jump the shark a second and say that when I was listening to Joe, when he talked about cumulative cultural evolution, and we're talking simultaneously from Colombia, New Mexico, and Vermont, some huge monster change is afoot on planet Earth. And just getting into the pulse of evolution, the evolutionary pulse as it unfolds, in what he described as cumulative cultural evolution, that gets me up in the morning. Like, I can feel just the juice of this conversation as our sort of minds swirl around this mega topic. So, you know, first, Glenn, thanks for, you know, bringing this up and having this conversation. And in a sense, it's like, Every place that we look deeply into the universe, like the Ammonites went extinct 66 million years ago, but the Nautilus version of the cephalopods survived. And why did they survive? We think it because they were at a deeper level in the ocean. So they were used to the darkness. They were used to the cold. So when the nuclear winter, the cold set in, they were able to survive. So I'm off on this tangent simply because what, you know, in answering your question, in a real nutshell version, it's inviting people to go much deeper than they've gone before, experientially, to go to places in their psyche, in their spirit, with the earth, to sort of say, we know what the surface looks like. All you have to do is kind of look at mass media, or have, you know, anywhere you look, there's the superficial level. And so I'm answering your question, Glenn, in a very different way. And we can get into the practical in another conversation, later on in this conversation. But for me, the key is saying yes to, if we really care about life on Earth, then internally we ask ourselves, it starts with me and you, I, in the true sense of that word. How can I really, really go deeper and go beneath the surface and not just stay, as much as the realm of ideas excite me, I'm talking about deep fundamental shifts in our, like how we look at reality. And one other last thing I'll say is that it's not about adding anything on. It's all built into our humanity, how to remember how to live in balance. I've seen this over and over and over again. And if you let me go on, I would go on for an hour because I'm so excited about this topic, but I'm sharing this time with Joe and I'm eager to hear what he has to say.
Well, I do want him to come back in, but I'm going to turn the conversation just a little bit because what we were advertising, because we're going to need to do that. So, and this is a tough one, but, you know. No, that's okay. That's okay. We like to do what we promise to do. So, Joe, I got the, you know, I don't know how many dollar question, but because that is immaterial, but how are we going to stabilize biodiversity loss and engage in this regenerative land change? I mean, how are we going to bring an end to this, you know, what's been going on with excessive nitrogen and phosphorus cycling? And I mean, basically, how do we stabilize this earth and to regenerate? I mean, I know that some of our listeners want to know some of the nuts and bolts things you've been considering. So,
yeah, maybe I'd start by saying that one of the really powerful things about the moment we're in right now is that a lot of what people are afraid will happen in the future was already guaranteed to happen as of 30 to 50 years ago. So like, oh, we need to avoid more greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 so that we don't have abrupt climate change. Sorry, not factually true. Complete delusion, sleight of hand technique for maintaining status quo. And so one of the challenges is, and I think this does relate to what Skyhatter's saying about deeply experiencing things, deeply, deeply experiencing the grief of the reality of where we are. And I start here because the main reason that people cannot devote themselves to regenerating the earth is because they're actually not in the present. They're not paying attention to what's actually happening right now. And I'm going to give just a really like mundane example. When I started doing watershed restoration, what I would do is I would wait till it rained. Then I'd run out into the rain with a pickaxe. And if it was at night, a waterproof flashlight. You know, so that like it could get wet. And then I would just go to where I wanted to redirect the water to go to where the trees are. And I would start digging so that it would be on contour, which means at the same elevation profile. But how do I know how to measure that? I don't have to. The water knows. If I start digging the hole in the right way, the water will just drift over into it. And so I could start having this little dance, this partnership with water, where I would start digging ditches with a pickaxe in the mud, in the rain. God, by the way, this is like my little inner child just coming out for a jubilee. It was so much fun. Yes, and I had the goofiest, stupid grins on my face when I was covered in mud and all wet with a pickaxe. And I was just digging channels of water for it to spread and sink into the ground. And so there's something so, so important about how regeneration, which is the pattern of any living system to continue living. So that's like in a nutshell, right? Is regeneration is the continuing recreation of the capacity to be alive moment to moment for any living being. Is that it's happening now. It's happening right now. So when that water is hitting the ground on an open area where they've already deforested it, It's on an inclination. The topsoil's already been eroded away, and we're at the clay level below the soil, you know, because the soil's gone decades ago in this specific landscape. And it starts to rain, and I'm like, I don't want the water to run, because if the water runs, it's going to scrape off more clay and dig more erosion channels. What I want to do is recharge the aquifers, which means I want the water to slow down and absorb into the ground. Now, you can already see there's a really big difference. I'm going to name a couple of things. I am in post-collapse in this landscape. The deforestation happened 50 to 80 years ago. I'm not trying to save topsoil. It's already gone. It was gone before the first time I set foot on this landscape. I'm not trying to bring life with water. I'm trying to help the water find the life that's already there. And I'm doing it by just recognizing the water knows where to go if I understand the principles involved. In this case, the principle is slow it, spread it, sink it, which is a classic saying in watershed restoration, which is the water that's running is going to begin to churn and turn. And as it does, it's going to rip up the land surface and create more erosion. So you want to slow it. And then you spread it. Why? Because water, when it accumulates, creates circulation and flow, which reproduces the same thing I don't want to have happening. So I want to spread it. Sink it just means I want it to go down to the tap roots and into the ground. And so I want it to go where life can really flourish, wherever the life may be. And so now we can go back to the whole planetary scale. The planetary scale, humans have degraded at least 35% of all of the land surfaces on Earth. I remember in 1999 reading a paper in the journal Science saying that we had already overfished more than 99% of the big game fish in all of the world ocean. That was 1999. Right. And, you know, and then I could just make this like list of horrors of things that have happened ecologically. And so it turns out the key to doing this regenerative work has very little to do with the outside world. It mostly has to do with a very specific thing in my own inner world, which is, can I see that I contributed, along with my species, I contributed to all of this destruction that has already happened? And then come to acceptance about where we are and see that these living system processes are really suffering. And that just like that steep slope without any topsoil and without any forest, that without active human intervention, it's only going to go worse. It's going to degrade further. And that the human role in this moment of a heavily degraded post-ecological collapse place, a place where the forest is already gone and the topsoil is already gone, the role of the human is to reverse the direction, to go from further degradation toward restoration of processes. And this is the amazing thing, is in this moment of seeing how bad it's gotten and accepting it, there's a gift. The gift is I have the power to use my intentions to change the direction from further destruction to further flourishing by understanding very simple principles, like slow it, spread it, sink it.
Good.
And so this applies to the whole planet. It applies at every scale of our ecosystems up to the planetary scale. It's accepting and seeing it as it really is, being present to that horror, which calms, because your nervous system calms after a little while, and then seeing that there are very specific, practical actions that are meaningful and purposeful, and that actually fill our heart and our soul in the midst of the grief, and that we regenerate ourselves while regenerating the land. Yeah. And that those are inseparable processes. So this is like the foundation of how to do this. There's a lot of Earth system science to get back to the planetary scale that we could talk about, but without this piece, you know, people would just walk along in the rain or run to the nearest shelter and not know they could grab a pickaxe, put a stupid smile on their face, and actually change the direction of development of a piece of land from further degradation to further flourishing.
Wonderful. Okay, and I want to turn it back to Bill because I think he's going to have a lot of reaction to what you just said. And I was really, especially when he was speaking about regeneration and being alive. It's amazing what you just said. Thank you, Joe. And I turn it to you, Sky Otter.
So what we're implying intellectually and pointing towards is that there's really only a cognitive difference between the inner and the outer, and this is something we made up. And so when Joe is talking about following the flow and slow it and spread it and the magic of water, I get so excited because so in the mechanistic reductionist paradigm we've all grown up into, water is like this sort of thing out there that we use, and we don't feel how we're we're one, we're made of water. And so some of the most satisfying, fulfilling experiences of my life are growing up in New York City and having opportunities to, just get the brick and the crap and the garbage and the shit out of the particular corner lot with a whole group of different people. And just that act alone was like liberation for the urban species. And so I'm cheerleading this idea that if you approach the conversation that we're having from sort of the spiritual or the somatic or the healing or kind of like, I know I need to do this inner work, or you approach it from like, I don't know if I really want to go there, but I sure as shit want to plant a tree. I'm with you 100% because it's life affirming life. And this is why this kind of this conversation is exciting. Like there's no, like you said, e pluribus unum, and it's sort of like, and no person left out. So it's like we build on everybody's gifts to give back to life. And maybe somebody is super, super traumatized in some way, childhood trauma, or they've been in a war zone or something like that. And so maybe maybe that primary gift back to life is to hold them so they can cry that water out of their eyes back into that place where the trees do not at the moment are not growing. But if we keep the water flowing, the trees will grow.
Mm. That's gorgeous. That's gorgeous. Yeah, I appreciate the way that you almost made you made crying into a ceremony, and there are ceremonies for tears, and that's really what's necessary. It almost was reminiscent of menstruation ceremonies where women give their blood to the earth. You're giving their tears to the earth. So it's very beautiful, very, very evocative. I've got one more question for you guys, and this is probably the elephant in the room. It's probably the hardest question I answer and stuff, but maybe I'll set it up by saying, giving an example of somebody else who did something that I was impressed by. There's a woman, I've met her, Lynn Twist. She's probably the most successful fundraiser on the planet. And she tells a story in her book, The Soul of Money, about how she was raising money for World Hunger. And she went into the offices of the president of the bank and to ask him for money. And she has a conversation with him, and he did give a considerable amount of money, $100,000. But during the entire conversation, the sun was in Lynn's eyes, and she couldn't see his face. And she didn't feel right about it because there wasn't an actual energy exchange. And so she went back the next day and she gave back the money. And she explained that there was this money was not given with true energetic intent. There was no genuine exchange. And that ended up changing that bank executive's life. He actually quit his job and started to volunteer for World Hunger. He started, you know, it made a huge difference. And Lynn became a successful fundraiser because, you know, she would talk to people almost like you were talking about a little bit here, Bill, with your ceremony about the with the tears being given to the planet. You know, she would talk about how, you know, if you really cared about something, if you really cared about it, then you should be willing to give very, very willingly, you know, to give to water the seeds you want to grow in the world, and also to give them light and air and soil. So you need to do those things, you know. She has made some changes. I'm sure that you both have had some success stories, but how does our culture as a whole, how can we reach what you described in your book, Joe, as the psychopaths? We don't need to name them, but they, you know, are sending, you know, missiles that look very phallic up into space or something to satisfy their egos. How do we reach people on that level and make a shift? And I kind of regret that question even away, because I don't really mean to put down anybody, and nobody really. And that's actually something I learned from Lynn Twist. I mean, the wealthy people, everybody's got a heart. Everybody can be reached. So how do we reach them? How do we reach them and create some change? I mean, Bill, you might have them take your Wild Earth intensives, but I don't know. We'll go to you first, Joe. And we only have like a few more minutes left, so we'll just a few minutes each, and then we'll go. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I want to start by saying that there's a natural organizing level at which human cultures can be sustainable. And that is a geographic range of landscape that achieves a scale that's sometimes called the territory, like the ancestral territory. And it also goes by a more contemporary, at least back to the 1960s, a name called bioregion. And so there's a naturally occurring organizing scale, which might be the scale of a watershed or a coastal estuary or a mountain range or a nomadic zone between mountains and plains, like the Ute people would have in the Colorado Rockies. But there would be this sort of geographic scale where the whole system can function. What's interesting about this, that's like, I'm saying that's sort of like an empirical fact. Like, there is a natural organizing scale, period. Just like to say it is. A lot of people don't know about it, but it is. But what's interesting, just like it's to say, there's a natural organizing scale for a hydrological cycle. You know, it's a natural organizing scale. And I mean it in that sort of factual descriptive way. And I say that to distinguish it from the other part, which is the part that can really move people, which is that most of us, like most of humanity who is alive today, are descended from indigenous peoples who were conquered by civilization cultures, which means all of us in civilization are the descendants of conquered indigenous peoples. And then there are indigenous people who were not conquered, and those are what we call indigenous people today. But actually, all of humanity was entirely indigenous for nearly all of human history until the last roughly 10,000 years. And then we started having city, states, empires, and civilizations, which means most of us do not know what all indigenous people know culturally, which is that they know that they are part, inextricably, part of a place. which is that they know exactly where they belong, because everything in their cosmovision, everything in their culture and in their life experience reaffirms for them where they belong. Whereas to be a lost child, like me or like any of us who don't know our indigenous ancestry, I'm a lost child. Who are my indigenous? I don't know. My mom's grandparents are from Italy. Who are my indigenous ancestors? I don't know. I've lost it, because that there was a cultural genocide at one point in time. And so the powerful way to reach people in regenerating the earth is restoring this possibility of belonging somewhere. To actually belong somewhere, and therefore to care about that place. So back in February, I was involved in a bioregional activation tour in the eastern part of the Great Lakes, specifically in the Greater Toronto Area, Finger Lakes and Genesee River of New York, and the Cuyahoga River in northeastern Ohio. So like a little corner of the Great Lakes. And then in May and June, we did a bioregional activation tour from the headwaters of the Colorado River to the Sea of Cortez and the Delta in Mexicali, Mexico. And in a week, we're leaving to do a tour of Cascadia, which is Cascade Mountain Range and Salish Sea in the northwestern part of North America. And the main emotional tone of the message I will bring is we're in planetary collapse. It's too late to do anything that is not holistic and transformative. And the secret right in front of our eyes is place. And if you know your place within the planet and you care for your place, then neighboring landscapes can help each other. As I work on my watershed, you work on yours, we engage in learning exchanges, and we can actually scale out across watersheds to entire continents. Because water already organizes land. So we organize ourselves around the way land naturally organizes. And when we do this, what we gain is a future, which is viable life possibilities for humans, and a past. Just even if I moved to someplace like Seattle and I didn't live there, I can now belong from henceforth. Now, henceforth, I belong to this place, which inverts the ownership paradigm. Instead of I own the land, as the land actually owns me, where I am among my own. I am in a web of kinship relationships, and I know where I belong. And the way that we can answer, where do I belong, is where will you gift your bones when you die? And so most people have no idea how to answer that question. But the answer is a place-based transformational strategy for identity and ecology, like for both. You that's get both.
What I do. That's yeah. what I do. What he just said, that's what I do. What he said.
Yeah, it's so huge.
That's what
so
I huge. Do. 100%. 100%.
Go ahead, Bill. You know, I mean,
It's like I use the word landscape, our landscape, that we belong to this landscape. It's reciprocal. It's reciprocity. It's all one system. When what we give, we get back. And, you know, my thought about, you know, about the psychopathy, the psychopath is just simply, they're the most traumatized. And so we include them in our prayers. We include them in our intentions. And in a sense, it's like we're saying that lost part of ourself is part of us. So to use that Mayan phrase, in la ketch, I am another yourself. So as I see you two as, you know, deep blood brothers in this, you know, in this digital space, the more I see us as the blood just running through my landscape, as Joe comes visiting here, I come there, we meet you in New Mexico, hypothetically or really, it's one way or the other. It's like, yeah, I just feel like No person left out. I mean, you said it at the beginning of the program. Mm-hmm. Does that mean I'm going to spend precious life energy? I'll do it through my inner work, as we've been talking about. Like, I'm going to pray with them. I'm going to invite them to the table. Whether they come to the feast of life, that's up to them. But I can't force anybody to come to truly feast at our table, because this table, Glenn and Joe, this is the most precious, most miraculous, most beautiful table that we could, like the creator or whatever you want to call infinite intelligence, the fact that we, you know, that we can breathe, that there's earth, air, fire, and water, that there's reptiles and fish and you know, and cyanobacteria or whatever, and stars. I could go on and on and on. The fact that we share this planet time right now, like, that's what Joe is asking us. Let's feel into the momentous beauty of this moment. Like, get down on our knees in gratitude. And if that guy, it's usually a guy, is like, you know, We're putting out the plate, man. You know, we're putting out the plate. Here's the good food. But I can't force this person to eat this food.
Well, you're getting those very beautiful answers. Thank you. You know, talk about belonging. I mean, I just love the word to belong. It's something that Grandfather Leon Secretario used to talk about quite a bit, you know, and the word has right in it, longing, you know, there's something about it that that we are all longing for. We want to belong. We want to be one. We're actually already are, you know, we already are. We already are. I mean, it's just a matter of realizing it, becoming aware of it. And doing something about it, you know. I mean, you guys mentioned my, you know, two favorite cities, you know, reciprocity and synchronicity. So, you know, I mean, those are my favorite cities. You know, that's where I like to hang out. So thank you. Thank you so much for an incredibly rich conversation. We could go on for a lot longer, but we've reached the end of our time for today. I hope to have you both back at another time. Thank you. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for bringing in the love, you know, thank you, because that's really, it's belonging and love and knowing that we're not above anybody else and welcoming them in to our circle. That is what we're doing here at Circle for Original Thinking. So thank you so much. This program is made possible in part by Select Books, Waterside Publications, BizGenix, and the Ecology Prime Media Channel. Executive producer Kenichi Sugihara. My main assistant, Kim Chappell. Native flute music by Orlando Secatero from the Pathways CD. Liberty Song by artist Ron Crowder, written by Ron Crowder, Jim Casey, and Danny Casey. Post-production editing by Kenichi Sugihara. The Circle for Original Thinking is a grassroots think tank whose mission is to seek out the deep origins of contemporary thought in order to remember and restore heart-centered wisdom for humanity and all our relations on Earth. Follow this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Listen Notes, or wherever podcasts are normally heard. For more information, go to originalthinking.us or originalpolitics.us, and you can find and purchase my books, Original Thinking and Original Politics, there. Thank you for listening, and until next week, many blessings of good health and well-being to all.